the investigation ramps up into the sinking of the cargo ship El Faro. Federal investigators take another look at deplorable public housing conditions in the city. And IKEA says Jacksonville looks like a good place to open a new store. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. And now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Then later, fundraising and some fun this weekend for the St. John's River Ferry. We'll tell you about it. Plus, festivals galore popping up all around town this weekend. We will spotlight one of the biggest ones. It's out at the Jacksonville Farmers Market, the oldest farmers market in Florida. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly roundtable. Lots of news to go over here today. Andrew Pantazzi of the Florida Times Union joining us.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, writer at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Morning.
And Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Guys, so good to see all of you. Plenty of news from the week to discuss. From that new IKEA store coming to town, pretty exciting, to fresh concerns about the public housing complex, Eureka Garden, and much more. But our lead story, first this morning, investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board are examining the sister ship of the sunken El Faro. The cargo ship lost at sea last week as it was caught in the maw of Hurricane Joaquin, killing all crew members aboard, about half of which hailed from Jacksonville. The big concern right now is to recover that ship's VDR, or voice data recorder. Senator Bill Nelson's office says he will meet today with the chief safety board investigator to get an update. Congresswoman Corrine Brown has also called for a Capitol Hill investigation into the El Faro sinking. So many questions about this tragedy. We want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Andrew Pantazzi, let's begin with you. In a letter to the agency, Senator Nelson says he's concerned about the safety policies of Tote Maritime, the ship's owner.
Yeah, so what we have now is the investigation process. It's expected to take at least a year before the final report will come out, but the NTSB says they will be releasing information during that time. So what they're going to be looking for is knowing exactly what did the company know in terms of sending the ship out, and also looking at how secure was the ship. Were there any problems on the ship? Were there leaks? We know that the contractors on board, the five Polish contractors, were there working on maintenance on the engine, trying to fine-tune it. And so exactly what condition was the ship in when it went out, and exactly what did they know?
Right. Claire Goforth, we have learned that the El Faro's sister ship had passed within sight of it. They were going in opposite directions on September 30th, just before the El Faro was caught in Hurricane Joaquin and lost power and sank.
Well, I did not hear that particular bit of news. I did actually speak with a friend of mine who's a retired merchant marine yesterday about this story. He actually sailed on a sister vessel to the El Faro. And he told me that vessels of this age, 40 years old, this one was, they were not originally designed to be a lift in, lift off. So they had to be retrofitted. And when you retrofit something, things are not quite as reliable as they are. You know, this technology wasn't invented. The lift in, lift off ships weren't invented until about 25 years ago. When you stack containers on the deck of a ship like this, they're strapped down. And it's very important that everything is done by the book, right? You know, but when the ship starts listing 15 degrees, if one of those straps snaps, because these straps are on the hatch, and the hatch was the issue, the hatch was open, and the containers fall off and the hatch goes, he said that you're dead in the water, because as soon as water gets into the main hold, it's over.
Literally. And if you're just tuning in, we're discussing the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, the sinking of the El Faro, and more. It's 549-2937 to join us. Tim Gibbons, A.G. Gankarski. The Navy, the NTSB need to recover that voice data recorder to try to find some clues into what might have happened.
It does. It has 30 days of battery life, so you know they do have to get it fairly quickly. The under basically 3 miles of water, not the easiest thing in the world to find. But, you know, in talking to the people we're talking to, it seems pretty clear that, like so many of these things, the whole confluence of different things, the age of the ship, exactly where it was in the storm, the issue with the engines, all kind of coming together to lead to the tragedy.
And AG, such a tragedy for the family members here in Jacksonville who had waited for days to find out any word at all. About half of that crew came from this area.
Right. And, you know, when we look at, you know, this tragedy, you know, we have to start with, you know, a real principle that it was, in fact, avoidable. You know, they knew there was a storm brewing out there. They knew there was a potential for the storm to build up. And the company made the calculated risk to go forward. That cost 33 lives. That cost the cargo, obviously, also. But, you know, let's focus on the lives for a moment. You know, and really the questions have to be asked is, like, who in the corporate structure authorized it to go forward? Did the captain act alone? I doubt it. It was somebody higher up.
It is the captain's decision, though. I mean,
yes.
There's a very good argument that the captain would have made that decision with the knowledge and foresight and possibly wanting to do what his bosses want. But, I mean, the captain of the vessel does make the call.
But what you're suggesting is that perhaps someone higher up the chain said, take a chance, even though the storm looks bad, we need to get that cargo through?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. You know, there, you know, quite likely was pressure imposed. There quite likely is pressure imposed in corporate policy. I mean, you look at anything like that. I don't think the captain acted alone. I think the captain acted under duress.
Andrew.
Well, I've spoken to 7 people who've sailed with the captain before, 5 of whom on the El Faro specifically. What those 5 people have said is that there was an incident at one point while he was sailing on the El Faro where he apparently stuck to the coastline and went down and it cost more fuel and he got in trouble with the company. The company has not confirmed nor denied this. I've reached out to them, but they said that the company was very involved in the day-to-day operation of the ship. So whether to sail or not is a different question, but at least in terms of once they had set sail, the company was very involved in saying, either you're going too fast, you're going too slow, you're taking the wrong route, you're costing us too much money with the amount of fuel you're expending. And so a lot of the former sailors who'd sailed on that ship say that the company should have known what was happening. So as the hurricane was developing, at least, the company knew that this ship was heading into it, and they knew exactly the route they were taking into the hurricane.
And as we wait for the investigation to reveal more information, Claire Goforth, it is a fact that the fallout will be major. Our local congressional representatives are calling for a federal investigation into this.
You know, if they're going to do a federal investigation into this, they should probably take a look at the entire merchant marine business, you know, industry in this country. I did a little research yesterday, and 35% of all of the fleet is over 25 years old. So we have a lot of old ships out there, and we have a lot of pressure to make these deadlines. My friend, who is a retired merchant marine, said that the captain could have made the decision not to sail, but then 2 days later he would have been fired, essentially.
And you also have the issue of this in particular is, you know, is Jones Act shipping totally within going from a U.S. point to a U.S. point. The entire merchant marine is a dangerous and, going on the high seas is very difficult.
Sure.
In this case, though, there actually is more oversight. You know, so as Claire says, the idea that this could be something that the feds actually could step in and have more control over.
549-2937 to join the show. Andrew Pantazzi.
And yeah, so this is a Jones Act case which means under federal regulation, if you're going from an American port to an American port, so this being Puerto Rico, part of America, you have to use American ship with American crew. And so you have more regulations. And so you've got a 40, 41-year-old ship that's going. Still, though, the crew says whether you've got a new ship or an old ship, the idea is if you don't have an engine that's working and you're going into a hurricane, then you're not going to have much luck.
There has been a fight to actually get rid of the Jones Act in part, though, because it adds expense and therefore you can't get internationally built ships. So basically imagine that everything we had to be made in America without cheap Chinese goods, you know. So the equivalent in the shipbuilding industry, it's good for American jobs, but it does, you know, mean people keep ships in service longer.
AG.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're headed for is a holistic systemic review. The problem with the particular investigation, we might not have resolution for 18 months, as the NTSB told the mayor's office this week. And You know, so by then, this will be long out of the headlines. So, you know, the real challenge for Corrine Brown, Bill Nelson, and other interested parties is, you know, keeping the pressure on during election year, keeping the pressure on to actually have meaningful reform in this industry.
What are your questions and thoughts about the sinking of the Alfaro cargo ship and the attendant investigation? 549-2937. Jeff is in St. Augustine. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, it's interesting they brought up the Jones Act because, you know, I'm not sure what impact on the overall U.S. economy, you know, merchant marine shipping has, but, you know, after this extremely expensive incident and no doubt going to be a extremely expensive investigation, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a movement to, you know, kind of get rid of the Jones Act and, you know, basically it'll all be all foreign ships with foreign crews. Which will be, you know, cheaper and unregulated. And as far as the course, I mean, they went directly from, you know, Jacksonville to Puerto Rico. Had they gone down inside the Bahamas and along the north coast of Cuba, they would have been completely clear of the storm, but, you know, probably would have added, you know, 20% to the fuel cost of the trip.
Jeff, thanks for those points. Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely right. You can stay along the coast. It's a much safer trip, and it also will cost more in terms of the fuel. And that's what, I mean, the former crew member said is that it happened once before, and the captain got in trouble for it. And so they believe that the captain was afraid of getting into trouble again. Again, I don't know if the captain really got into trouble, and I don't know whether that was a consideration.
And we may never know.
Right, no, that's always the problem, where you have, you know, so if he had taken that route, obviously, you know, nothing happens. The company goes, see, you know, you were concerned about nothing. Instead, tragedy happens and, you know.
Sure.
And one of the former officers who had sailed with him, so there's two types of people who are sailing on these ships. You have the officers who went to maritime school, and then you've got the non-licensed who are the ones running the ship in large part. And one of the officers who had sailed with him before said he's one of the most cautious people and that actually he got fired from a previous job because he was so extraordinarily cautious and costly in terms of all the precautionary measures he had taken.
They wanted him to be more aggressive.
And companies were asking him to be more aggressive in order to make more money.
So is it a scenario where the profit margins for these companies are pretty thin?
I don't know. I mean, Tim might have a better understanding.
Yeah, I mean, the entire trade between Puerto Rico, we've had one company who was in that business go out of business last year. It is a very tight market. The Puerto Rico economy is, you know, kind of crappy, and everything that goes there needs
that's
to be
a shipped. Technical term.
It is. It's because we call it business reporting.
Bankruptcy happening.
Can you say that on public radio?
Let's go now to Trevor in Jacksonville. Hi, Trevor. Go ahead.
Hello, ma'am. I had a quick question. So I'm wondering how this is playing out in the national media. I hear a lot about it locally here in Jacksonville, and how this sizes up in sort of the history of maritime disasters. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, there have been some infamous shipwrecks. The wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald comes to mind in the 70s and others. Claire, Andrew?
Well, this is actually worse than the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yeah, it is. It's worse.
We went back and we tried to find the most recent disaster that was worse than this. And you got to go back 57, 58 years into a long time ago, almost 60 years ago, to find one of a similar amount of.
Which one?
Of course you'd ask me.
there hasn't been a ship of this size lost anywhere in the past 4 years.
Right.
So
right.
I mean, the idea that, you know, this is ships don't just, you know.
It was, again, on the Great Lakes, I mean, similar to the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Okay. Mike at the beaches. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey there. I'm calling because I've got a lot of friends working in the industry, and, of course, my heart goes out to all the families who've lost people that were crew on this ship. But I wanted to speak to the Jones Act real quick. The Jones Act is in place not only to keep American sailors in work, but it's also because the merchant marine is how we get munitions to foreign battlegrounds. No one else takes them. The merchant marine takes them. We can't have foreign flag vessels shipping our gear to the battleground. So it's as simple as that. So if the Jones Act goes away, not only does American shipping go away, but the ability to have American troops facilitate their munitions to foreign battlegrounds, that also goes away. So the Jones Act cannot go away. Thanks.
That's Mike at the Beaches. Thanks for that.
I just kind of love the fact that your show this morning turned into a discussion about the Jones Act, which is something that I particularly find, you know, fascinating. So
I know. Well, we have some very informed listeners, don't we?
And he makes a really good point. The entire idea behind it is we need trained merchant mariners, and you know, if we don't require it, we go to the lowest contractor. We go with foreign operators.
There's also a strong argument to be made that if we don't have this, we also don't have people who are capable of building ships within America, which also affects our Navy. So if we don't have people who are building our cargo ships, we also are going to have less people capable of repairing and building.
Although still a fraction of the cargo ships that are built.
But still, I think this discussion is revealing there are a lot of tentacles to this story. Let's go to Linda in East Arlington. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just wanted to point out about the regulations and all on these ships. It, to me, goes back to the problem we're having in Washington. We have this group of people that are fighting regulation, and we constantly are having breakdowns, but it's because we cannot push regulations. That's a bad word. We have this problem with the shipping industry. We have it with the auto industry. Look what happened with Volkswagen. Everybody knew this was going on. It's not new. We have a big problem up in North Dakota and all with this fracturing, and the environmental agency can't go in there and get a handle on the regulations. There's a lot of dangerous work going up there, and people are getting hurt and killed, and there's nothing there for them. And so I think the country needs to look at this mantra that all regulation is bad. This is the reason we have regulations. That's the reason this country has become as great as it has. And I just really think that's something that a lot of people in this country need to think about. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Thank you, Linda. Here's a tweet from a listener basically saying the same thing, Claire. The regulation, the listener tweets, "The regulation problems with the shipping merchant marine industry remind me of the issues with the coal mining industry."
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent point. And Linda also makes an excellent point. You know, when we have to balance business interests against human interests all the time in government. And when we really give credence to the business interests and want to deregulate and want to make things more simple and streamline everything, then the very tragic reality is that that comes at the cost of human lives eventually.
AG.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue. But you know, another issue also is just the declining value of the dollar in general. The real issue is, as mentioned, you know, declining margins for these companies. And these are non-negotiable realities because, I mean, we can talk about the human interest all we want, but what prevails in campaigns, what prevails in both parties is corporate interest. And unfortunately, I believe that's going to happen again.
Let's go to Bobby on the north side. Hi, Bobby. You're on the air.
Yes, many people said what I wanted to say, but it is part of a larger issue. My son's a truck driver, and, you know, they're real tight schedules, real tight profit margins. They push those driving envelopes, and we have all these, you know, many disasters every day with, you know, 18-wheelers running over people. And it's all about the pressure of saving a few cents here and a few cents there. You know, we all be bone the regulation from Washington until we have a disaster and we need it. We need, as a nation, need to step up and fund what it takes for us to be great. If we have to pay a little more in taxes, great. But our infrastructure is crumbling, our roads. I mean, at some point, the cost of your goods are going to go up because the infrastructure is in such bad shape that it's just going to cost more to do it. And I'll take my comments off there.
Thanks, Bobby. Lots of calls. The number to join the show is 549-2937. And speaking of regulations from Washington, or maybe the lack of them, federal inspectors are taking another look at the subsidized apartment complex Eureka Garden in Jacksonville after city inspectors found mold, pests, and very unsafe, dangerous living conditions.
That was a great transition.
This, even though the complex just passed a federal inspection. It passed, amazingly enough. Mayor Lenny Curry and City Councilman Garrett Dennis are calling on the feds to reinspect these apartments. Andrew Pantazzi, Mayor Curry, saying he's horrified that children in particular are living in these horrible conditions.
Yeah, this is nothing new. Eureka Garden has been the bane of Warren Jones' existence while he was city councilman for many years. And now it's proven to do the same for Garrett Dennis, who represents that same district where Eureka Garden is located. What this is to explain some of federal housing. So this is under HUD's local field office. They have site-based multifamily housing units here. And then you also have the Jacksonville Housing Authority, which is separate, which would operate Section 8 vouchers. If this were shut down, if they did condemn this, if something happened where they were able to nullify their contract with the nonprofit ministry in Tennessee that runs Eureka Garden, then they could instead give that money to the local housing authority to issue Section 8 vouchers. And the way those work is people could go anywhere in the city, use them at any apartment or home as long as they met inspection and were approved by the housing authority.
Do you think they'd be able to afford to rent an apartment with those vouchers?
So the way the voucher is supposed to work is it's supposed to take a calculation into effect saying what you make, and mostly it's people who are working and making money, you have to pay 30% of your salary toward rent, and we will match the remainder of that because that's what's considered affordable housing, is being able to pay 30% of your salary.
You know, it was striking to note that just as the mayor was deploring these conditions at Eureka Gardens, the leader of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, Sherry McGill, pointed out that there's a new data tool that's being used around the country to help poor neighborhoods and weak housing markets that could be used in the northwest side of Jacksonville to lift up people in poor housing developments. And she implored city leaders to take a look at this. This is not a new issue for Jacksonville. Claire?
No, it's not a new issue. And I mean, as horrible as the conditions at Eureka Gardens are in the infrastructure, the squalid living conditions, I mean, it's really tragic. The real issue in Eureka Gardens is a lot bigger than that. I mean, when you Google Eureka Gardens, the second result that comes up, shooting.
Right.
Because there have been so many shootings there. I watched a couple of YouTube videos that were supposedly shot there yesterday and of people just pandemonium fighting, you know, it's a really bad situation. And I think it makes me think of a pressure cooker where you put people that have been oppressed for centuries into a situation where they just really can't get out. And then it explodes in violence and chaos.
AG.
Well, you know, what do you want to say? It's, you know, we've gone for decades with Eureka Gardens being in the situation it's in. People brought attention to it. It was brought to the attention of the Brown administration in 2013. Nothing was done. They just basically ignored it, had some community empowerment days. And, you know, Mayor Curry has, you know, taken the action that he's taken on it and actually gotten code enforcement out there. But here's the wrinkle. There are 27 code enforcers in Jacksonville. They're really understaffed. So court enforcement efforts that are happening over there, happening at the expense of other code enforcement efforts throughout. And, you know, this points to bigger issues with the city in general. But the fact that we haven't had action on this, you know, for decades is absolutely shameful.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Some will use Eureka Gardens as an opening to argue that public housing assistance doesn't work and needs to be cut. Tim Gibbons.
Public housing assistance of that sort, you know, is problematic, you know, not just here. The problem is there is no good solution. So Section 8 vouchers, you end up basically with a decentralized many places that people are living at. Those 27 code enforcement officers can't hit all of those. So now you end up with basically, you know, subsidized slumlords.
Well,
that creates an issue as well.
Well, the difference there is that the Jacksonville Housing Authority has their own inspectors on staff. And so they're the ones who are tasked with going to—
Still, though, Section 8 housing, you know, across the board is not— it does create a incentive for people who have marginal housing, who are getting these government vouchers, you know, and are not places that people necessarily would want to live without having, you know, the help of the government.
Ron Littlepage had a column about this today where he noted that under Mayor Jake Godbold, who was raised in public housing, he went up to Washington during the Reagan presidency with a Winn-Dixie shopping bag full of keys to these apartments, dumped them on the bag of the housing official at the time and said, "This is now your problem. Fix it." Apparently did get a little traction. The Curry administration is making noise that they're going to do something similar and basically demand some better outcomes from the federal agency tasked with managing oversight.
And I think when you look at housing advocates, I mean, they will tell you that this type of model of housing, which is this single site, multifamily, large scale, where you've got a fence enclosing people in, lots of public areas where people can gather, that's not the model that we want to go toward. You want more of the scatter site housing, that's been pushed more across the nation, including with the housing authority. Or if you're going to do a multifamily housing unit, you can look at the Durkeyville area that the Jacksonville Housing Authority has.
Well, AG.
Yeah, we have 30,000 vacant and abandoned houses in Jacksonville right now. You know, that's an opportunity. Another opportunity is, you know, you've got vacant lots also. You can build multifamily units. I was talking to Garrett Dennis about this yesterday, and he was saying that could be another option too. We've got to think outside the box and come up with 21st century solutions because, as you know, we keep saying, you know, this mid-20th century, you know, basically project is not working.
The number to join the show, 549-2937, as our media roundtable talks about the biggest stories of the week. Well, did the Jacksonville firefighters violate Florida's sunshine law? New text messages from Jacksonville City Council members obtained by the Times Union show. Firefighters Union President Randy Wise was texting council members during a meeting last month as he also worked behind the scenes to sway a vote prohibited by Florida's open government law. Wise apparently was texting the members, then relaying what they had to say to other members on the governing body. The state sunshine law strictly prohibits public officials from discussing government business with each other outside public meetings or using a third party to communicate.
This was great reporting by the Times Union. I just want to start off with that. One of the things that I find interesting about this is I'm wondering at what point somebody, because you know somebody had to realize what they were doing was wrong. Were they purposefully using Randy to communicate, or was it more Randy just saying, hey, I got this information, let me pass it on and do lobbying? I'm just curious who basically instigated the idea of let's communicate this way.
Well, I mean, if you even just look at how Chris Hong, at my colleague at the Times Union, he went to the city council meeting. They voted on a measure to move the drainage funds to offer promotions in the fire department, and then they voted it down, and then later they brought it back up and voted it up. And the first thing he said when he came back is, I'm requesting the text messages of each of those city council members, because how did they do that without any discussion decide to change their minds? And he requests the text messages, and someone like Katrina Brown, her executive assistant, says, there are no text messages, and then come back and say there actually, well, maybe there are.
They actually do exist. Councilman Bill Gulliford, Clare, says he's going to introduce a new rule, to quote an HBO host, new rules, cracking down on real-time lobbying of council members during public meetings. Under the proposed new rule, council members would be prohibited from responding to text messages coming from lobbyists, union reps, and officials from the mayor's office.
I would wonder if their assistants will also be prohibited from responding to text messages from lobbying groups. You know, this has been some really good reporting by the Times Union. I definitely am disappointed in city council on this particular subject. I'm wondering if this is really just evidence of something that's been going on for a long time, and now we're just becoming more aware of it because of the story.
Of course, not to be cynical, because I hate that. but one of the things I always find interesting about these stories is that they really do simply bring to light something that everybody kind of, of course they're doing this. And like, oh, wait, now we have written proof.
But AG.
You know, I think we're doing a lot of hand-wringing over this. We're being naive. We're pretending like Paul Hardin and other lobbyists aren't in City Hall 5 days a week talking to these people over and over again. We're pretending like people don't have pre-existent relationships with Randy Wise. And, you know, we need to look at the story in the context of who benefits. You know, who on council has the most heat with the fire union? John Crebeny. And, you know, it seems entirely plausible that John Crescenbenny is sitting there really enjoying this, because it kind of vindicates what he's saying, which is that, well, council and, you know, the fire union's in bed. But if you talk to people on council who are part of the sex message thing, they're saying they did nothing wrong.
Well, I'm going to disagree here. So what's going on here is not just that they're getting text messages from a lobbyist or that they're meeting with a lobbyist. This is a public meeting where city council members are talking to one another in a public meeting, but privately. They are texting Randy Wise, who is then relaying their text to someone else. In our Florida Constitution, we have it clear that we need open meetings. If city council members are going to meet to discuss what they're going to do or what they're going to exchange in terms of funding, they need to do that in the public eye.
Well, what's the remedy, though? I mean, the remedy is to take away the promotions, as the concerned taxpayers are suggesting. And, you know, you do that and you've got a lawsuit from the fire union because you got promissory reliance there. You got a bunch of firefighters who are basically relying on these promotions, who basically have mortgages, kids in school, et cetera. And we're doing this over $300,000 in the stormwater fund. And if you know anything about stormwater, $300,000 isn't going to do much.
Wait, well, so you're arguing this isn't an important thing? I mean, I don't think anybody is actually upset about the idea that Randy Wise is lobbying city council. That's part of his job. I think the idea, as Andrew says, is the council people should not be talking to each other in secret. And the fig leaf of, well, I'm going to tell you and you tell the other guy doesn't make it any different.
And they should have a cure meeting, which is where they should rediscuss these issues and have to re-vote on them with actual public discussion. If you read Steve Patterson's story today, you saw that downtown is flooding right now, that there are streets where you can't go at night because of the high tide. I mean, clearly this is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Maybe there's even an ordinance against the high tide then, because, I mean, realistically, you're not going to stop these lobbying relationships, and the $300,000 is not a big deal, and the story has been really blown up for the last week. And it's really been something that's been made to villainize like a half dozen council people who honestly thought they were doing the right thing.
But I don't think anyone's arguing that we get rid of lobbying. I think we're arguing that that public officials stop circumventing the Sunshine Law.
If they're going to break the law, then they're committing a criminal violation. And if they want to spend a year in prison, because it is a third-degree felony if you're knowingly and willfully doing this, then fine, we can send them to prison for a year.
And at least don't do it in writing. I mean, if you're going to do it, at least, you know, talk to the person and have the person convey the information. You don't do it in writing.
And you know Snapchat, you know?
Right, exactly. Right,
yeah. Hey, guys, we are running tight on time. running out of time to talk about the emergency 90-day audit of the city's finances. Great work by AG of Florida Politics, looking at some serious concerns with the city's finances. And one other news of note, lots of excitement this week for fans of IKEA. The hugely popular home furnishing store with a global cult-like following, the Swedish company announcing it will open a store in Jacksonville in 2017 at Gate Parkway and I-295 that will hire about 250 employees. Tim Gibbons, a big business win for the Lenny Curry administration and a big win for the city in terms of cultural cachet.
It very much is, although, you know, to be fair, IKEA started seriously looking at Jacksonville basically in the spring, so I always love when politicians get credit for stuff that happened on their watch. But
that's right.
But
that's right.
People have been looking for IKEA for a long time, and we have an editorial today, you know, with Trader Joe's, IKEA, Nordstrom. You know, Jacksonville is actually kind of getting there.
Now, let me ask all of you, have you been to IKEA?
No.
Yes.
Never? Yes. Okay.
We have traveled to Orlando and to Tampa. I mean, I do think this is the type of store that, unlike Trader Joe's, you're going to see people who are willing to travel
from
long
distances.
People
will drive. AG, would you drive for an IKEA?
I wouldn't drive across the street for an IKEA, but that's just me. I know a lot of people will and do, and it's, you know, really we're getting to that 2 million person metropolitan region threshold.
This is a benchmark of...
You know, we're going to see a lot of this stuff coming here.
This is a store that famously says, we won't open in a city of less than 2 million people.
2 years ago, they said that Jacksonville was... The quote, it was great. Their spokespeople are actually like refreshingly straightforward. Guy said, yeah, you just ain't there yet.
I guess we are now.
I would like to quote one of my friends, Caitlin Ludke, who said in response to the news that if the construction workers, though, have to follow IKEA directions, realistically, the store's probably not going to open until 2020.
Yeah, they do. They do ship the store here in a huge flat box.
When I lived in Chicago, the thing to do was just to go to get the lingonberry pancakes. We never even bought anything. You just went to the cafe. The food's good.
You tweeted about that
yesterday.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
She's very excited about those pancakes.
All right, finally.
AG is not.
I can, yes, I know. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. Only in Florida do guys text as they speed along I-95 on their motorcycle.
Are they lobbyist?
While being chased by police. A sheriff's office helicopter's camera in Martin County caught the guy riding with no hands and texting during an intense police chase. You see him take both hands off the bike as he's being pursued along I-95. The chopper pilot forced the biker off the interstate to end his erratic driving. Thankfully, nobody hurt.
What was he texting? You know, gonna be late for dinner? It's like,
Only in Florida do suspects set up fake job interviews only to steal people's urine samples. Tallahassee police say 19-year-old Gerald Washington posted a fake online ad that he was hiring more than 1,000 people for jobs. He set up a temporary office, got their social security numbers and their urine samples, all for positions that did not exist. He collected bank information for the applications, even charged them $25. The duped job seekers were even told what day they would start.
Okay, I'll say this may be terrible, but it's also brilliant.
It is. It actually is. And finally, only in Florida do candidates for the state Senate stand accused of goat sacrifice. Yes, Libertarian Party candidate Augustus Saul Invictus, that is his name, allegedly ritually sacrificed a goat in a pagan ceremony. Now, this all came to light when Adrian Wiley, the chairman of the Florida Libertarian Party, resigned last week in protest, in part because of Invictus's claims that he is destined to lead a second civil war. And he's also pretty popular among white supremacists, but also because of the whole goat thing.
And apparently drank the blood as well.
We don't know what his name was at birth, but Augustus Saul Invictus literally means majestic unconquered son.
But did he text anybody about the goat blood?
That I don't know. But thanks to our media panel, Tim Gibbons, Claire Goforth, A.G. Gankarski, and Andrew Pantezzi. As always, wonderful. Thanks to see all
Thank
of you.
You.
And
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy the southern winter just a little bit. You bring the sunshine, I'll bring the sunscreen. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Life has enough drama.
Seems we've gotten a bad batch of grits, and we think it comes from Minnesota. They've made everyone feel gloomy and guilty.
Oh. And reality.
Can we not do this? Can we just not do this?
I'm going to have a practice funeral.
Find a way to forget your troubles.
With ping pong, trap shooting, hopscotch.
And gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion returning Saturdays at 6.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast Connect Book Club returns later this month with a discussion of writer David McCullough's biography of the Wright brothers. Get a free copy of the book. Just check it out from the Jacksonville Public Library. That's our book club partner. You can also buy a copy from Chamberlain's or the Book Nook. And then send us your thoughts to bookclub@wjct.org. Here's what we want to know. Send us your memories of your first airline flight. How old were you? What was it like? Good or bad or scary or fun, just send us your thoughts. Bookclub@wjct.org. Well, let's talk for a little bit about the St. John's River Ferry this weekend and celebrate it with Ferry Fest coming up tomorrow out in Mayport. Not only can you ride the ferry for free, there's lots of other fun in store. Founder Elaine Brown and Brian Bush, event co-chair, join us now with a preview of Ferry Fest. Good morning to you both.
Well, good morning, Melissa. It's so good to be here.
And someone's phone is going off. You
sorry
bad, bad
sorry.
Kids.
Sorry.
No worries. Elaine, let's start with you. This is exciting. Ferry Fest is not only a fundraiser, it's a party.
It is such a great party. First of all, Melissa, do you know that it's been 4 years? This is the fourth year, and that every year we have been on your show. And I want to thank you personally for that. Remember the first year we were saving the ferry?
That's
the
right.
The ferry was being saved.
That's right.
You know, and for 2 years, that was really our whole theme.
And there was a real concern.
There was a huge concern. And now, you know, for another show, maybe, you know, we can give you an update on the JTA taking over. But right now, now is Fairy Fest time, and it starts tomorrow. And there is so much surrounding this one this year. But the ferry is free all day, and we want people to come out and enjoy the ferry ride.
That's right. So come on out, ride the ferry for free tomorrow. Brian, what else is going to be happening?
So this is the first year that we're going to do a treasure quest up in Fort George Island. So we kind of wanted to connect Mayport with the national parks across the way. And so we're going to use JTI shuttles to leave from the Hexer Drive Ferry Terminal in the morning, go up to Fort George and do a little treasure quest. And there'll be 15 time challenges, and we'll have up to 100 teams competing. And then the finalists will come back into Fairy Fest for a trivia contest.
Oh, very nice. And then in the afternoon, it looks as though there will be an historic marker dedication marking the French Huguenots' presence in the area. So some history as well.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh,
that's huge. That it is such a great thing that's being done. And what we actually have is that it's a dedication to Jean Ribaut, and it's honoring the French Huguenots. And we have so many. Lynn Corley put this together with the Historic Society here. But I'll tell you something that's really cool. We have the support of some of our representatives, like Ray, who is a historian, by the way. And I think that we have so many VIPs coming out, including, you know, Greg Anderson from the city council and Bill Gullerford. And so and some of our state representatives too, just to make sure. And then there's going to be an actual throwing of a wreath off of the ferry as it goes out. And it's just going to be a really beautiful ceremony, again, open to the public.
Wow. And it's important to note that the ferry is a bridge. It's Jacksonville's first bridge. It bridges the two sections of A1A, Brian.
That's correct. And then following the historic marker, we're going to have live band performances by Canary in the Coal Mine, the band Tala, Rip Currents, Sidetrack Band, and then following up Scholar's Word. So we're very excited to have them as well.
Right. And you know, Elaine, as you said, for years now, you've been coming on this show talking about the ferry. And for people that have never come out and ridden the ferry, it's a neat experience the first time you do it. Many people depend on the ferry every day, commuters, to get them across that point of the water to their jobs, to school, because it is a bridge that connects that artery.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. You couldn't set me up any better than keeping A1A open in North Florida. A1A is what we consider to be our economic development for tourism, you know? Get people off at Ferdina and experiencing the whole A1A. And the ferry is that link. And it is a bridge. And, you know, we're very proud to say that we've been able to get a lot of grants in the city of Jacksonville and now the JTA to really help support this. But it's people like you that understand that it is needed for tourism and it's needed for the people that commute, you know, on A1A.
So free ferry rides tomorrow. Lots happening starting early in the morning, but going all night, a party into the night. This is an all-day, all-night affair, it sounds like.
About 8:30. You know, this year, too, we want to put a big emphasis on children. We have a lot of children's activities. We've got, you know, a big slide in there and a
bounce house.
The bounce house, yeah. And we got a lot of kids that are going to be teenagers that are coming from Fletcher that are going to be volunteering to watch and make sure that the children have a good time. But more important, you know, you've got a lot to do out there. We've got the treasure quest. We've got trivia on the stage. We've got trivia and treasure quest for Mayport. And then, my goodness, you've got arts and crafts galore.
Food trucks.
Food trucks. Mm-hmm. What are the food trucks? You know, you got a lot of food trucks coming, Brian. And it's everything from ice cream to great food.
Lots to do. So much to do. So get out and enjoy the St. John's River Ferry Fest. All day, all night tomorrow out in historic Mayport. Brian Bush, Elaine Brown, Friends of the Ferry, thanks for being with us. Have fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Parasite zapping drugs, a life-saving DNA repair kit, and the mysterious mass of the neutrino. It's this year's Nobel Prize-winning science. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for the details on these discoveries. Plus, how an app is helping parents and kids with math anxiety. all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio. Listeners love Relax Radio.
My name is Harry Reagan. I got hooked immediately because it's just the kind of radio station I've always been looking for and never found until now.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 or go online to wjct.org/relax for more information.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, a hint of fall is in the air, and this weekend, the oldest farmers market in all of Florida is inviting you to get out and enjoy it. Greg Tyson is with the Jacksonville Farmers Market, and they've got a big fall festival coming up Saturday and Sunday at their location on West Beaver Street. Greg, a great family event. I was there last year. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, it will. Thank you for having me this morning. And we look forward every year to doing this now, and we try to make a bigger event every year, and we're just excited about what we're doing this year. We've got several sponsors, and our main sponsor being St. Vincent's Health is going to be helping us with this, and just looking for a good time for a whole family.
Now, you're going to have the Jaguars, the Armada, Edward Waters College Choir. This goes beyond the hay bales, the pumpkins, and the face painting for kids. You've got a lot happening at this thing.
We've got a lot happening, and of course, as you mentioned, the Jaguars and the Armada and Edward Waters College will be out there tomorrow. Only on Saturday, but throughout the day with their events. And it's just an exciting time. We're building this as a fun family day, and look forward to seeing the crowds come out and enjoy, you know, the fall weather starting to kick in a little bit. And we're going to have food vendors out there, different types of food, as well as our own restaurant that's open out there every day of the week. And of course, all the fruits and vegetables, and as I left the market this morning, we were starting to get in loads of citrus.
So, oh, nice.
You know, we're starting to get in the product for the fall.
Now, let's talk about the history of the Jacksonville Farmers Market a little bit. Not everybody around town is familiar with it. It is the oldest public farmers market in Florida, founded in 1938. Just an incredible history.
That's correct, 1938, and I remember as a little boy. Visiting the old market right next door to its location now with the old wooden buildings. I'd go out there with my folks and my grandparents and as many people in Jacksonville who've been around Jacksonville most of their life have. And, of course, we've relocated to right next door with more modern facilities and just really made it a better market. We're in the process right now in talks with individuals and contractors about upgrading our facilities. We've been talking about this, I know, for 3 or 4 years, but we're getting to a point now by this time next year, we hope that the public will see a big improvement in the market out there and just keep growing.
So as you grow to expand, you still sort of have the value, though, don't you, Greg, of keeping the produce prices low, because people come from all over the region to get their hands on this amazingly fresh, locally grown and sourced produce for incredibly low prices.
That's correct. You can still find a bargain out there. I was in the grocery stores just yesterday, one of our local retailers, and looking at some of the prices and trying to compare mentally what we have out there at the market, and you can save a pile of money out there for a good family.
What do you, when you go through the stalls, what do you buy? What do you shop?
Oh, I buy just about whatever the wife tells me to. You
know? What is she like? I mean, like, when I go out there, I'm amazed by the variety, and I can spend $5 at the Jack's Farmers Market and come home with a big bag full of great stuff.
That's correct. We're meat and potatoes type individuals, vegetables and what have you. During the seasons, we get whatever's in season with the fruits, you know, strawberries maybe during the winter season and early spring, citrus this time of year coming in. Just a wide variety of product out there. We have also specialty vendors out there throughout, some during the week, but mostly during the weekend where we have the baked goods. We've got a seafood vendor out there all week long who has fresh Mayport shrimp and fish and oysters that he gets from other parts of the country. Just a wide variety of a selection of food.
And so it's an opportunity to come out, enjoy the fall festival, get some great bargains on not just produce, but seafood and other goodies, and have a great time. It's the weekend fall festival at the Jacksonville Farmers Market Saturday and Sunday.
Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. each day, and things, you know, we've got some main events throughout the weekend, but some things are Saturday, some things are Sunday.
Greg Tyson, thanks so much for joining us. Hope for good weather this weekend. I think it's going to be a nice weekend, so I've got my fingers crossed.
I think the weatherman's trying to cooperate.
That's right. So whatever you do this weekend, get out and enjoy this hint of fall this October. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have feedback for us, we always want to hear it. Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast, now up on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at the week's top national news stories. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday with a preview of the One Jacks Institute's forum coming up on the UNF campus, Gun Control, a Loaded Topic. A preview of that discussion on Monday's show. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.